morning and welcome to our meeting, 9:00 AM on April 16th, 2024. I need to convene a regular meeting with the Snohomish County PG Board of Commissioners. I'm Tim Logan, President of the Commission. To my right is Tony Olson, our Vice President. To my left is Rebecca Wolf, our Secretary. To the table to my near right is John Harlow, CEO General Manager. Colin Willenbrock, General Counsel. Melissa Collins, Commission Executive Services Director. We also have Alice Morrison, Clerk of the Board. Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Solzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. This session is for the Board and CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PG staff. Commissioners, are there any changes to be added or items to be added or changes to be made to the public agenda?
Yes. Item 01F, 00, add at places additional slide. Number 13, proposed leave program changes for non-represented employees.
Thank you. All right, first agenda item is our General Manager briefing session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. Again, we have a packed agenda for this morning. Lots of good stuff. I'm going to start with the opportunity that we have that I want to make you all aware of. And I'm going to read the notes so that I can articulate this as succinctly as possible. When the minimum daily charge was retired on April 1st as part of the base charge implementation, it caused a billing issue for our net metering customers, which we have about 500 solar net metering customers. Instead of the net metering customers paying the base charge as they were doing for the minimum charge, they were able to apply their production credits to the entire bill, including the base charge. This is against our net metering program policy, which only allows production credits to be applied to energy charges. It has resulted in some net metering customers receiving zero bills and having their remaining production credits saved as an account balance instead of placed in their net metering credit reserve. Our IT and finance teams are all over it, working on a fix that will ensure the customer charge is fully applied to bills of net metering customers and not covered by their production credits. And the fix should be in place by the end of May at the latest. So full court press to get that addressed. It was just one of those things that we did not anticipate happening or occurring. And again, the teams, what they go through to implement those rate changes and all that stuff is way over my head. Pretty sophisticated, pretty complicated, and this was just one miss that we had, and we're going to get it taken care of. And we have a full court press from a communication process that we will be proactively reaching out to those customers and trying to figure out the best way to make sure we manage this until the fix is in place.
I do have one question. Given under the law, are we obligated then to recover lost revenue? If they were paying zero, again, I don't need an answer now, but that was immediately came to mind.
The short answer is yes, but there are certain parameters in terms of how far we look back.
Okay.
In addition to what was recovered.
All right, yeah. I do agree with what you said, but in terms of when you go back. Thank you.
Thanks. Glad we're on it.
So next up is our 2023 audit results, and that will be Sean Hunstock. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioners. I'm Sean Hunstock, Senior Manager, Controller, and Auditor. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce our external auditors from Moss Adams. Before I do that real quickly, I do want to acknowledge the efforts of the staff in the General Accounting Department. Specifically, if I can embarrass you and have you stand up real quickly, Michael Pixler and Will Garber. Michael and Will are instrumental in completing the requirements that we have for the audit and responding to the audit request of Moss Adams. So I want to acknowledge Michael and Will. Thank you. As well as Maxwell and Tyler Wells are a reporting and compliance manager. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce Olga Darlington from Moss Adams. She may be a familiar face. She's been on the audit for a few years now. Olga is the partner in charge of the district's financial statement and federal single audit. And with that, I'll turn it over to Olga. Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning. Get a little closer to the mic, please.
Good morning again. All right, welcome. Thank you. All right, results of the 2023 audit, just a few highlights for you. I'll cover the audit reports were issued, do a very high level overview of the financial statements and financial results for 2023, provide some required communications that we are required to provide to you by our auditing standards. So the highlight of my presentation is the that we issued unmodified opinion on the district's financial statements for year ended 2023 on the district-wide financial statements, as well as on each individual system presented, electric, water, and generation system. In addition to the financial audit, we did perform a compliance audit, which this year had a little bit of an increased scope with two major federal programs that we had to audit. First one is the Department of Treasury program. That one is more familiar, probably called the Arrearages Grant. That was the second portion. First one was provided in 2022, and this was the second portion that was provided in 2023. We tested that program and allocation of those credits to customer accounts. And then the FEMA grant was the second major program for all of those different programs that come through the different FEMA grants. So. Also, no findings on the compliance audit, no internal controls issues over compliance as well. So all in all, once again, a clean report card for the district's financial report for 2023. Overall, the financial results for 2023 were very positive. Net income recognized in all three systems as well as district-wide. We, during our audit, of course, do look at internal control environment, particularly ensuring that billings are correct to the customers and collections are made timely. We'll look at the disbursements and payable controls, payroll controls, and overall financial reporting controls, as well as IT environment in which all of those financial transactions are processed. Capital assets, lots of projects, lots of work going on. Each system had a significant addition to capital assets and construction in progress during a year. So we do take selection of projects, test those costs, make sure that those projects that are completed are capitalized correctly and depreciated timely. On the debt side of things, water system debt bonds in amount of $18 million this past year. So we did test the just receipt of funds and making sure that the repayment schedules are set up. Also, for all of the debt outstanding, we do confirm those balances at the end of the year, make sure that payments are made timely, make sure that debt covenants are met for the bonds, as well as the review of any arbitrage, potential arbitrage liability. With the interest rates going up, we do see arbitrage becoming positive in the coming years for some entities, so that could become a liability in the future. There was none in 2023. Of course, we look at the revenues and expenses, doing some analytical procedures there. The revenues were up this year. We also do test the unbilled receivables at the end of the year, and those are the services provided through 1231 that haven't quite been billed to the customers because of the billing cycle cutoff time. There was one new accounting standard implemented in 2023. Every year I say there's one new that resulted in a restatement of a prior year financial statement. So subscription-based information technology arrangements was another new standard, very similar to the leasing standard that we talked about last year. Although the overall impact wasn't significant, the restatement of 2022 presented information was still required, and it's disclosed in great detail in note 5 to the financial statements. Right. Overall, the In mounting policies, I disclose in footnote one, particularly we focus on those that are management estimates. As I always mention, the management estimates are something that assumptions that we have to test. That's not something we can confirm with a third party or look at the supporting invoice or documentation. So we have to evaluate assumptions that management uses in recording those balances. For the district, I mentioned unbilled revenue, allowance for doubtful accounts for customer receivables, accrued balances in general for claims and contingencies, actuarial valuations for pension plans and leases and speed of receivable, or lease receivable and speed of liabilities as well. Our audit was performed in accordance with split timing and scope. There were no surprises during the audit, which is always great. We do have good communication with the accounting and finance team at the district throughout the year. So when we come to the year end audit, there are no surprises about significant transactions that we would need to address in our audit. Financial statement footnotes are very consistent with previous years. As I mentioned, one new policy implemented for subscription-based information technology arrangements. The rest of it is very, very similar to prior years. Not a lot of changes, all in accordance with GAAP. We did not have any disagreements with management in performing our audit when it comes to application of accounting standards or accounting policies. So all in all, good news. We did not have any past or recorded audit adjustments. And this is, it sounds uneventful, but it does speak highly about integrity of the financial information that accounting and finance division presents to management and to you throughout the year. So we, there were no findings of any kind in terms of incorrect balances at the end of our audit. Moss Adams is independent with respect to the district. We do consider fraud in our financial statement audit, although we don't design procedures to address fraud. We do change up our procedures every year, and the accounting and finance will attest to that. We'll try to ask different questions and ask different supporting documentation and do different tests throughout the year just to make sure that our audit approach is good and not stale every year. There's a summary of some new standards that will be coming up in the next couple of years. I'm not going to go in great detail on those, but good news is they're not as much of an undertaking as the last couple of years of standards have been. So we get a little bit of a break for a couple of years before GASB kicks it up with some new significant significant GASBs in the coming years. This is our lead team on the audit. If you have any questions after today's meeting, feel free to reach out to any one of us. Of course, this is just the leadership team. We do have a bigger team that supports the audit, and we did perform the audit virtually and on site here throughout the month of March this year. And I want to echo what Sean said before my introduction, is that huge thank you to the finance and accounting team here at the district. We do talk to many people throughout the organization, not just the accounting folks, which we ask a lot of questions. We ask a lot of information. So it's been a very good process for the audit, very collaborative. We did get support for everything we asked. As I mentioned, there were no disagreements. And just in general, the short timeline that we have for completing the audit is thanks to them, because they're prepared for us when we come to start the audit. And just it's a big undertaking. That completes my presentation. Thank you.
Any questions, Commissioner?
I have none, thank you. Just a question of clarification, and it may not be in this audit, but what should the board, there's no reference to the governing body in here. And in this audit, in the past, hasn't there been some reference to the, you know, board input? Our audit of our records. Okay, I didn't get an answer, so I'm on the wrong audit.
The presentation is intended to those charged with governance.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. It's It's good to have an anticlimactic presentation.
Yes.
Thank you, Olga. And we do appreciate the relationship that we have with Moss Adams and Olga's team. Next up is our water supply update, and it's Mike Shapley. Morning, Mike.
Morning.
Morning.
Morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
So last time we met was about 6 months ago, and today I'm just here to give you an update of our water supply 24 through basically the end of March. And I'm sure you've all been informed how we've transitioned into this water year and how tough it's been. So this will hopefully provide you a little more detail on how we got here. So informative today, won't be requiring any action at all. So we'll take a look at our PUD energy mix, which has looked different in the last couple of years. Take a look at the summary and then what we to look forward to for water year 25. So this is a summary of our PUD's power supplies portfolio for 2023. And what is different about this than what we've seen in previous years is, of course, that our hydro supply reliance has been mostly in the mid-80s. And you can see from 2023, we actually only received about 78% of our supply from hydro. And the result of that was made up by market purchases. We saw this past winter too, 2024. So summary of what we've seen so far, October 1st through the end of March. So the water year is right about actually 81% of the 30-year average. This is just in the past week. We've seen some declines just based on forecast of precipitation or non-precipitation and drier conditions. But as we began the water year in October of 23, soil conditions were very, very dry. And so that's how we entered it, kind of in a deficit to begin with. We had an El Nino winter forecast, which really came true, meaning that we saw some really wet and cool conditions in the southern hemisphere. You probably read in the Phoenix and California area, very cool and extremely wet compared to what they generally will see. And then for us in the northern hemisphere, we saw warmer conditions, warmer than average. Precipitation was less than average as well, but not significantly so. I'll get to that here in some further slides. So as of right now, we're forecasted to be 66th worst water supply in the past 76 years. And that's pretty significant because we've seen some pretty poor water years in the past five. So California really benefited from above average precipitation. This is for the second year in a row, which has been great for them and some of their reservoirs. Jackson Hydro, if we look at some historical data there, 87 to present, about 80% of average in terms of generation and 87% in terms of precipitation. Had a pretty low reservoir going into the year, and so that's why you see that difference between generation and precipitation. Hancock Creek and Calligan Creek, we have some data there. I wouldn't hang your hat too much on these numbers, but because they're startup units, we had problems initially. So, but as we gather more historical data, we'll see some of these generation and numbers come in a little bit different. But 97% of average for Calligan and 134% of average for Hancock. I might mention Hancock is a bit higher because had some real issues with the farm startup, and so that kind of skewed the average this year in terms of the amount of generation we got. And then Creek, again, a young project, but 2017 to present, 101% of average with 94% of average precipitation.
Can I ask a question before we leave that slide? So 2019 to present?
Yes.
That would be through 2023?
Through the end of March, correct?
Through the end of March?
Yes.
Oh, end of March this year. Year. It says it at the top. Okay.
Correct. Yeah.
So that is difficult for you to calculate.
Yeah, again, because the projects are so new and we had some issues, you know, early on. And these projects, of course, are offline a lot of the year because snow melt is gone. And generally we see, I think last year, we were offline from basically March through, all the way through October, right? Because no precipitation to speak of and no snow melt.
How do you get an average?
You know what? I would have to defer to my folks in the generation group. These numbers came from them. So again, limited data. I was thinking about not putting these numbers in here. Yes.
But you do, I want to know.
I did. I thought about that. So I can get you more detail if you need it.
Well, I'm interested in how people come up with certain data, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it sounds like, to clarify, this is the average based on the short life of generation. It's not necessarily the average of the precipitation in those in the basins.
I believe that they are both the same, that we're tracking the data for both exactly the same.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
And the other two commissioners were about the best.
Mm-hmm. What was the question?
Do you guys support staff to bring that up? Rena?
Yes.
Do you guys support staff going back and bringing that request?
Sure. Yes.
Well, I'm very interested in the Calico handbook.
I understand.
But I know it's a tricky situation because of where they are and so forth.
Okay. All right, so I want to look next at the basin maps. And so the left map is looking at seasonal precipitation, beginning of the water year, October 1 through the end of March. And so I've kind of boxed out some areas that are significant in terms of precipitation. You can see, as I mentioned, the southern part of the hemisphere, well, in our basin as well, you can see the greens and blues are above average in terms of precipitation, particularly on the bottom right, which is the Snake River Basin. And then in particular in the north, we saw some seasonal precipitation in the upper Columbia that was below normal, mostly for a lot of that basin. And we did see some averages that were near average in the western part of that basin, but it's really defined more by the map on the right, meaning that upper Columbia saw warmer temperatures than normal, so a lot of that precipitation that may have came as average came as rain rather than snow at some of the elevations there. And that's where we're seeing you know, the upper Columbia in a deficit in terms of snow again this year, even more so compared to last year. But they're managing the reservoirs up there pretty well, and I'll show you some data that supports that.
Wait, can you remind us what SWE is?
Snow water equivalent.
And it's interesting that Oregon has a lot of snow, as I recall reading.
Yep.
The Capital Press, which is really oriented to farmers, but I've been reading it for a long time, several years. It's a very well done, except for the editorials.
And again, this is just pointing out what I mentioned early on, that the southern part, including this part of our basin, has gotten really good precipitation with some cooler temperatures too. Okay, and then I wanted to just show you some of the temperature anomalies that we saw by month. And so again, this takes us October through March. So when we look at the oranges, we're looking at temperatures that are above average. And so you can see that we started October above average across really the entire basin. And then as we moved into November, kind of a mix, but mostly normal to above average, and then December was extremely warm throughout during, of course, these months when we hope to be building snowpack. January, different story, really weighted mostly by that 1 week in January during MLK, not even a full week, when we saw significant temperature anomalies, in some places 30 degrees cooler than average. And so that temperature map is a little misleading because it's really just weighted mostly on just that 1 week period, we call a peak week. And so February, same thing, warmer across most of the basin. And then for the month of March, we saw mostly average conditions in terms of temperature. So this is where we were getting when we were talking about the warmer than average conditions so far this water year. If we look at precipitation, it looks very similar to that the two maps that I was showing. See a lot of the dark blues, which are above average precipitation, but focusing really mostly on what we rely for long-term supply in the Upper Columbia. Started October, very dry, yellows and reds up there, and same with the month of November. We got some better precip in December, but it was kind of a mix in January and saw some good precip in February, but unfortunately at warmer temperature, so it didn't help snowpack much.
So, Mike, if you look at the previous slide of the one before,
yeah.
So I understand the temperature's lower in some areas, but I guess I'm not clear on where most of the snowpack is. So if the temperature's lower than normal, like it was in March, for along the essentially the border of Washington, Oregon. Is that an area that really is historically collects a lot of snow? I wouldn't think it would be.
Right.
So how do you mix these two to understand where snowpack should be and isn't?
Right. The Northwest River Forecast Center does a really good presentation once a month during this period that will focus more on the basin where it collects water, because of course snow in an area that really is just going to run into a river and out to the sea doesn't do much good for water supply, right? So it's some of the bigger reservoirs like the Dorshak Reservoir and the Upper Snake River Basin, and then of course the Mica Reservoir and some of the larger reservoirs in the Upper Columbia. Grand Coulee, of course, is another one that's significant. So did that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess I'm just wishing Noah had a different graphic that would sort of show us where we are in the snowpack right now.
Right. What I can do is I'll forward you a direct link to the Northwest River Forecast Center's monthly presentation page, and you can go through each one of those presentations that they do, and I think you'll get a better idea.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
I do have a follow-up question.
Yeah.
My memory is that you said that in Canada they're managing their reservoirs well. And you're smiling at me. What did I do?
They're managing them better.
Well, I'd always thought that it was very important that the flow from the Upper Columbia was on point to our generation here.
Absolutely.
No? Yeah, okay.
Absolutely, right, right. A couple more slides, I think you'll get a better idea of what
okay.
I'm referring to.
Thank you, sorry. You bet.
Okay, so this is just a stream flow of actual water volumes, again, that's presented from the Northwest River Forecast Center. And what I just wanted to show here is that really October through March, the amount of water supply volume wasn't that bad. And again, it came as precipitation that flowed through the system and we had generation, but what really suffered was some of the reservoirs that needed to be filled too. So a lot of that came through the system, some of it was stored, never really came through us in terms of actual generation. But I wanted to show you that on average, it hadn't been a horrible October through March in terms of precipitation and water supply or water volumes. But it's mostly going to be impacted by the fact that the snow in the areas where we wish we had it is not there because it came down as precipitation through the system and filling the reservoirs. So May through July are forecast to be below average. May and June in particular are not really that bothersome for us in most cases. It's really when we get into the summer period, July and August, that we love to have plenty of supply and volume of water to sustain fish flow, and then of course generation when we need it for those really hot temperatures that might be coincidental here in the Northwest and California. So the reason I wanted to show you this too is that in July, where we're forecasted to be below average, there are negotiations that occur between BC Hydro and BPA, where we can pull storage from projects when there are price signals that offer, you know, releases of additional water. And again, a chart here shortly will show you that BC Hydro and the marketing arm of BC Hydro Powerx is doing a good job at not using the water that's there to ensure refill. They've been importing like crazy. Really, on an hourly basis, their tie is like 900 megawatts, and they've been doing that pretty consistently through this winter and into the spring as well. So this chart is just painting a story that we saw last year and now into this year, and some of the challenges that we had this winter with some inflexible resources that came through our federal system. And so three lines there just represent a minimum, an average, and a maximum that we've seen across our new BPA contract 2012 basically through 23. The bar charts there are what we saw this year. I really started it in September because I wanted to show you that month as well was at this period low. Every month was right there. We even had a new low for January, the month, of course, that we really needed additional generation. It was really only this last month of March that we broke above the minimum average in terms of total generation for our dispatchable federal resources. Tough year so far. This is what I was referring to in terms of the Canadian reservoir and storage, so water stored behind the dams. This is a composite of the group of BC reservoirs. And so it was in February that 2024 was ranked 16th, and you can see that 2023 is there on the bottom. But I mean, look how poor some of these water years have been just recently. 2020, 2021, and 2022. But this year, 2024, the amount of storage that BC Hydro has is now near average, which is great. I anticipate they'll be above average here shortly. This is a snapshot of about a week ago. And this is gonna be really important for summer and winter operation. Remember, our snowpack in the upper Columbia is below average, call it 75% roughly. So once snowmelt begins in the very upper Columbia, we want to make sure that they have that water in those reservoirs, and they want to make sure that, of course, they're above average in terms of storage. So this is where I believe that pointing a pretty good picture that they're doing a good job of importing a lot of relatively cheap energy right now to make sure that they're not using it during this period of time, saving it for summer and really important for winter time as well. And this is, I think, a really telling graphic of what the Grand Coulee Reservoir has done since, I have it just charted out here, since December, when it's really a pretty narrow band. So these are years 2016 through this year. 2024 is the line on the top. So by comparison, where we our beginning April right now is 44 feet higher than where we were last year, and significantly higher than where we have been in previous years. So great news, we only have 5 feet of room to capture the runoff, and of course, the Northwest River Forecast Center, BPA, BC Hydro, you know, they manage that because we don't want to spill, obviously, but we need to be full by the 4th of July weekend. And I think it's really telling just to show how we have been hovering near that top since early February. And really, July, we drew down the reservoir as much as we could, given the constraints that we had. Pretty significant 1 year to the next. So in good shape at Cooley, but it's in a place where there's not much snow to come anyway. So I think we'll be in good shape to not fill the reservoir too much, but precipitation can always change that. But right now it looks like we're gonna be conditions that are below average in terms of precip.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Was it last year that they did the drum gate maintenance?
Yep.
So that was why I was not drafting so much.
So last year, we did drum gate maintenance that requires you to draft down below 1255.
Right.
This year, we did not.
Yep.
That was my memory.
Yeah, and the Corps of Engineers also every month posts a flood control elevation that you're required to be below based on forecasts for what type of snow and water supply is out there. So this is a unique year. I mean, we have a flood control elevation that is 1283, full is 1290. So flood control is really non-existent, right? We've seen in great water years like 2012, we had to draft the reservoir down to 1220. So 70 feet below full. Gives you an idea how poor this water year is, and really even last year was worse in terms of water supply.
Mike, maybe I missed it. So is drum gate maintenance not happening this year because it's not needed, or because it's deferred because we have a bad water year?
Correct.
Yeah.
Water.
On both. Well, so it's always needed if they can, but they have deferrals as long as you do it in so many years out of seven. Which they met that qualification this year.
Great.
Sorry. Yeah.
I felt last year was like a more major operation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your memory is right. Correct. They had in addition to normal maintenance, they had one other item that I'm drawing a blank on that was really needed. Okay, so that's really it. I have just a slide here showing that what is forecast now to be a fairly strong La Nina winter, which usually reaches its maximum strength October through February. We're due for a good water year. I'm hoping that will be the case, but cooler and wetter conditions generally to the north, not always the case, but that's at least what the forecast is at this point.
By the south, you mean California?
Did I say the south? I'm sorry, I meant the north. Cooler, wetter conditions.
No, drier conditions in the south.
Yes, exactly true.
So, like California, especially in wildfires.
Yeah. Warmer and drier conditions to the south, yeah. 2015 was really probably one of the worst years that we saw there. Significant, yeah. Any questions at all?
Questions for Mike? Can I get you to go back to slide 8?
Sure.
So I look at this, Chris, I've looked at this so many times now over the years, but I pick up something every time. So when I look at this compared to load in the region, I would assume December, January, February are the peak loads. And so in every year, we have there's a lot of water supply in April, May, and June. So is that mostly sold, or is that reserved behind dams for August, September?
So,
very general question, there's so much more water available than our need at the instantaneous heat.
Right, so specifically talking about April, May, and June, right. Wind is a big driver too, because we have so much in not just this region, but other regions. So lowest loads, April, May, and June. Historically, last year we saw a really cold April. But correct, that's where that chart of Grand Coulee showing the flood control draft. They based on forecasted conditions of all the snow and what has been observed and what is planned to run off. They're generally trying to time it so that the reservoirs can fill when we don't need the power.
Okay.
And so.
So a lot of this will go to fill.
Right, but remember.
Some of it will go to slice, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. Correct. But remember, I mean,
we're almost there.
Yeah, right? 5 feet yeah. from it. So. And like I said, BC Hydro has done a really good job importing inexpensive power and not exporting out of the reservoirs. So that is really going to be the big driver for the summer, is having those full reservoirs up north. And don't anticipate there's going to be huge additions to snowpack, and then even in the very upper Columbia, but we can see some additions there as late as early May, because you're talking about elevations that are, you know, 10,000 or higher. But precipitation forecasts right now aren't looking great.
Any follow-up questions to that?
I have none.
Thank you, Mike.
I'll make sure to get you that additional information.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Great job, Mike. Thank you. So next up is our energy risk management report. Peter Schoenhauer. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Welcome.
I'm Peter Downhauer, the senior manager of the Economics Energy Risk Management Department. So I'm joined by Dr. Anna Kruglova, who's going to be sharing the presentation with me today. And we also had contributions here with Felician Eng, an economist also in the department. So we're going to be talking about the Energy Risk Management Report. And the purpose of this presentation is to fill you in on what's been going on with our Energy Risk Management Committee over the last 6 months. It's informational only. Just a reminder of recent meetings where we've talked about similar subjects, and you can kind of track the evolution of the program here, going back all the way to 2021 quarterly, and then moving to biannually. And then we had our last workshop in 2021, the very end there. So our agenda today is to cover the energy risk background and fundamentals, go over the sources of risk, where we'll look into kind of the variations in different types of risks that we see, and then do a retrospect to Q4 and Q1. So that's the period which this covers, Q4 2023 and Q1 up to the end of March of 2024. And then just a short segment on the risk program plans and update on what we've been doing to kind of change the program around. So starting out, background. So the PD staff makes our best efforts to anticipate both the consumption of electric power by its customers and our supply of electric power available, and then engage in transactions to meet those customer needs in a dependable, safe, and responsible manner. And these transactions include buying and selling, scheduling electric power, options for electric power, and other energy commodities as necessary to meet our load and mitigate risk. This leads us to some of the key strategies that we are sort of guiding lights here, is that we're constantly defining and updating our uncertainties and risks related to our resources, our load, and our load demand, and also our market prices. We try to keep a market position near neutral in the short-term horizon, defined here as 36 months rolling from where we are. And we keep exposure to market prices below limits. The limits are set by to cap the impacts of market movements to no more than a 3% rate increase. We also need to balance that and consider the within-month risks that we do also face. Things like the MLK weekend come to mind, where we might have very short-term periods where market prices are high and we also have high needs. And the market is sort of constrained a bit. And we transact market operations over time to help average out the market variations, which is what we call the glide path. Before we get into the sources of risk, any questions on the sort of background slides that I presented there?
Questions, commissioners?
I have none.
Okay, then I'm going to take a moment to introduce you. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Anna Kuklova. I think this is the first time that she's been at the commission, and she's been at the district for about 9 months now. We're very, very happy to have her. So just a little bit about her. She's an economist specializing in risk here at the PUD. She's also a postdoctoral researcher at the Center for Insurance Policy and Research, where she explores the impact of climate risks on financial stability across industries. So it's great to have that experience as well, and that sort of research coming into our thinking as well. She holds a PhD in business administration from the University of Washington and a master's from MIT focused on finance and risk mitigation. Previously, she held fellowships at UCLA and Imperial College London and led the quantitative research group at the Central Bank of the Russian Federation. She now resides in Edmonds with her family, and she is also a certified hunting dog trainer and an accomplished figure skater and pianist. She's originally from Russia's northern Urals, and she enjoys Washington's mild climate and floral abundance. So please, welcome.
Welcome.
I don't think you have a lot of space.
My question is, when do you have time to sleep?
So, Peter, thank you for the introduction. Good morning, commissioners. Let's talk about risk. So, how this operates. So, as Peter mentioned, we face two types of risks. First, risks related to resources and load variability. And second, market prices. Let's start with resource and load variability. On the right side of this slide, you can see a plot that summarizes 5 years of hourly resources and loads. So on the horizontal axis, we have months from January to December. On the vertical axis, we have our megawatts. So red boxes and lines represent loads, and the blue boxes and lines represent resources. So how to use this plot, how we can read it. Let's look, for example, at the load, right? Imagine that you are recording consumption of your household every hour, like how much electricity you're using every hour. After 5 years of observations, you have a lot of numbers. And you have this very nice tool, box plot, basically to visualize these numbers. So how it's constructed, right? You arrange your loads from smallest to highest and look at the central cluster. So the smallest loads when you were on vacation, right, and turned everything off. The highest load, for example, you had extremely cold day and you turned on all the heaters in the house. So the central cluster would represent your typical consumption, right? So it's still not one number because you can turn it off different appliances over the year during morning and evening hours. But this is kind of the typical consumption that you have. So this is a box. Every single month, this is a box with variability within the typical consumption. You can see also the so-called whiskers, lines, and dots. These are hours with that when you were on vacation, for example, or turned everything on. So the dots, these are outliers. So when you consume a lot of electricity, right? It's not typical consumption by any means. But we're curious about the outliers, right? Because they're unusual. That's why there are dots on this plot. So what can we learn from here? First, you can see that we have two different types of months. Look, for example, at May, June, July, August, right? Our boxes for load and resources far away from each other. And resources definitely higher than the typical load, typical resources. And look at the June, for example, I like this month. These dots, outliers for load, they are actually within a range of typical resources, right? They're by this little blue box. So we also have another type of months where these boxes for load and resources very close to each other. Look at, for example, November, December, January, February, March, right? So we can see that variation within typical range, slight deviation, can cause kind of problems, right? For example, let's look at January, right? Let's assume that we have a load that is an upper half of the red box, right? And the resources in the lower half of the blue box. Oops, we have deficit. We need to buy electricity, right? But imagine even more interesting situation when you have load in January that about 1600, right? It's still plausible, but your resources just within your blue box. So, and this is a situation where you have to go to the market and buy. Right. So this is the first fact we learned. Months are different. The second fact that there are outliers, and they are in the months when the load and resources box is close to each other. So this is kind of what we have here. We use this knowledge to revise our forecasts, right? So we use this historical data to form our plans, budgets, next month expectations. So the second, let's go to the second.
Can you go back to that previous graph?
Mm-hmm.
So January really sticks out to me for the outliers. We've got all these outliers, the majority are high load, and then resource, we have all these outliers, whether it's low resource. Can you speak to that? I always think of February and December for some reason. Obviously, this January, we have a lot of outliers.
Yeah, this is historical data. So our low temperature driven, so it's basically the historical temperature patterns that we observe. If you want more information, I'm more than happy to dig deeper and very curious about these distributions as well.
Yeah, maybe I can say something to that.
Okay.
Just to that.
Clarify.
Just to maybe add a little more information there. So, you know, this includes all hours. We'll include both the heavy load and the light load hours. And so when we have flexibility with some of our resources and perhaps other periods where we have no flexibility but just low resources, you know, these can be at these points where we don't necessarily, we aren't sort of coinciding it with the very highest peak. And so
right.
I think what it's showing really is us sort of flexing where we can to not use energy and use the market where it's cheaper, and instead flexing and using that when we need it most. And so I think that, you know, you see a lot of the outliers in the bottom half of the resources side, and a lot of the outliers on the top half of the load side for that reason.
Let's look at the price variability. So at the right side of the slide, you can see a plot, which is kind of similar. This plot, again, has months on the horizontal axis, but prices on the vertical axis. This plot summarizes, again, the same 5 years of data. This is hourly statistics, and we can see box plot for prices. Again, within these little tiny boxes are our typical prices on the market. You can see that they are actually not very high, so definitely below hundreds here, 100, right? So, and you can also see black dots. These are outliers. This market behavior is very typical for energy markets. We can talk about this later offline, why this happened. But we have a lot of outliers. where price can jump to 1,000. You can also see the color coding, January, February, March, April, and October, November, December, colored red. Basically, these are the months we learned about on the previous slide. The red months, the months where our box is full of resources very close, so where we have higher likelihood of being short of resources. And this combination, killer combination of outlier prices and our need to go to the market creates a risky environment for us. So given this variability that we observe in prices with the likelihood of being short of resources, we try to avoid depending on the market when prices are high, right? Any questions?
Questions, Commissioner? Great graphics.
So let's look what we actually do about it. So we decided that it would be beneficial for us to hold reserves, extra reserves, especially during the months, for the months where we have to go to the market and the prices are high. On the right side of the slide, you can see a plot that's showing our reserves. On horizontal axis, we have months from January to December, and this plot without vertical axis, because we want to show the relative size increase of the new reserves, these are yellow bars relative to the old reserves, dark bars. You can see that the size of the yellow bars, new reserves, bigger, almost two times bigger for January, February, and December. We studied these extreme events and decided that this would be a good strategy, right? To ensure that we have enough electricity for everyone, that we are reliable, staying reliable supplier of electricity. So basically what we are doing, so we're forming extra reserves. Also, we are increasing our planning horizon to 36 months into the future. It was 30 months before. So we really want to be prepared to this critical months in advance. Questions?
Questions, commissioners?
No.
I guess I'm not understanding exactly what the volume, what the y-axis is. Is it volume? Is it?
If it's energy units, yes.
Okay, and then the percentage is along the bottom.
So, for example, let's look at the January. The difference between yellow and black and the dark bar, right, if you subtract it, the difference will be 90% of the black bar. So it's how much more reserves planned.
Okay, those go with the months, I understand.
Yeah. Oh, and this number is shifted, unfortunately.
Yeah.
In this, okay. Next slide. Okay, let's look at the energy risk. What I mean, just resources, load variability, and prices in retrospect. So here our resources. So what we learn from here. So this slide has two blocks. The top one is a table showing actual supply of resources relative to planned supply of resources. If this number is below 100%, so actual resources, we have less actual resources than we planned, right? If the number is above 100%, we had abundance of resources, more than we planned. You can see that numbers in bold, all below 100% except of March. So we expected more resources and actually had less. This is the first observation. The second observation, if you look at the wind, the role for the wind, you can see that the percent actual to planned actually changes a lot. from 63% to 116. This shows how wind is unpredictable. So it's very hard to plan for this resource. So the bottom part of the slide, you can see the plot. So it's basically we selected the most volatile resources and plotted them against the plan. So the gray line, it's our planned amount of this variable resources. And the wiggly line, it's cumulative amount of this resources. So this is the top line. This is, by the way, stacked plot. So the top line is basically aggregates all variability of all resources mentioned. So the wind is in this kind of greenish areas, and the slice is this like a light blue area.
Interesting observation about the wind and when the wind was low and when the wind was high. Very, I mean, December, good wind. November, October, and then February.
It's hard to predict. This is the challenge with this resource. So let's look at the load and our demand. So the slide has the same structure. It has two blocks of information. On the top, we see a table with actual relative to planned loads, consumption of electricity. Let's start with this piece of information. Again, if the number is above 100%, so the actual load was higher when we planned, if below 100%, lower than we planned. If you look at the bold numbers, you see that almost all numbers what else we can learn? Look at, for example, November and January, right? The load is above 100% in both cases. Look at the plot below. So the load here is the dark line. So the load in November just almost uniformly above the plant. So yes, it's above 100%, but it's above 100% almost everywhere. Versus January, load above plant, above the plant, but it's like concentrated in a couple of days. So this is different dynamics this month. So let's talk more about the plot. So again, we have our timeline on the horizontal axis, on the vertical axis we have megawatts and temperature. You can see the cold snap we experienced in January, and comparing lines, red lines and dark lines, you can see that it's because of the temperature drop. We had increasing load because of the temperature drop. It's almost one-to-one correspondence here. Questions?
So this is the average daily, is that what this is, the graph?
This is the average daily.
Yeah.
So let's look at our prices. You can see that during this cold snap, there is a jump in market day ahead and real-time prices. This is expected in a sense behavior. If we know about this temperature change, we would know about the jump in prices in a sense. But to predict the exact the magnitude of the jump would be still a problem. These events of extreme market jumps are rare on the market. And yeah, we expected some increased prices. This situation when the prices jump to $1,000 per week.
So if we had our new reserve policy, it wouldn't affect the price really, because that's a regional thing. It would just affect how much we'd have to go out and buy.
Yep. Okay.
Have you any idea what the magnitude of how much we bought versus if we use the new reserve policy, what it would be?
So for the future or for the past?
If Martin Luther King weekend happened, which I think we have about $40 million purchase of power, extra unplanned purchase of power, if we use the reserve policy, do we have an estimate of what that, how many million that would be?
So we run back tests. So back tests, okay, I will talk about this a little bit. So back tests include not just one event, but what would happen with our P&L, with our financial result over the span of 4 years, for example, 3 years, a year. So holding reserves is expensive. So buying reserves and holding reserves. It's up to us to decide whether we want to be exposed to this market jumps but have lower costs, or we want to be more secure and hold extra reserves, extra length, and avoid this kind of, avoid the situations. So I think the optimal solution is a compromise to have some reserves, because it's extremely expensive to hold everything, all reserves to cover everything. So yeah, so the truth is somewhere in the middle. Some reserves and have some exposure to the market, because these events are rare.
Right, no, I understand it's a challenging question, because if you hold on to reserves, that cost is your point. Yeah.
And maybe Peter wants to jump in here, because we did ask very similar questions. What if we would have had the new reserve policy in place, not just for that particular period of time, but for the 12 months or 18 months, kind of, you know, going back and forward to that?
Sure. Yeah, as Anna said, we did some back testing on that in particular. And so, not to get into all of the details, but you know, we've had some pretty tough years and some pretty tough markets here. And so, you know, we think that it, you know, would have been significantly beneficial to have more reserves over these last 3 years that we looked at in particular, and particularly in January. You know, I think what we can do is when we look at the peak week slides coming up, you can consider if you had an extra 100 megawatts or 50 megawatts or 25 or whatever it would be, that's all money, you know, and energy that we wouldn't have to buy at those prices, and see some pretty significant prices. That would give you an example of it. I will also say that, you know, Anna was right in saying that, you know, there's a compromise to make, and so we're really kind of trying to tune in what the right value is, and so that's represented in the new reserves. Targeting that capacity in these types of situations, that we carry the right amount, not too much, not too little, always spinning.
Right, so they would have helped us these past 3 years, but it potentially would have cost us in a more normal year.
Yeah, and I think we can get back to you with some kind of more detailed analysis if that's what you're looking for.
I'm getting what I'm looking for. I'm just trying to understand the.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that we'll have more to come on this.
Yeah, for sure. And the thing is, you go back prior to these last 3 years, and yeah, we were operating in the black. But we think the current market, or the last, you know, 2 to 3 year market, is likely to continue.
Yeah.
Right? If you just, again, go back to all the conversations that we've had around load increasing and supply potentially even decreasing without having any new technologies that are commercially available for load following and dispatchable.
I think about storage. In the IRP, we are talking more about adding storage. So if we, I mean, is there a scenario in which you think about how much we would need to manage the gap?
Yeah, I think the IRP does a fantastic job of giving us an answer and a direction on that. And, you know, when we look at our capacity needs versus our energy needs, I mean, that's really what's driving that answer. This is how many capacity type products we need. And IRP tells us that answer. And it's, you know, gives us a sort of projection into the future of how those capacity and energy needs might change as all the variable change, variables change, but that's exactly it. I think if we have some RP folk here to see anyone just now to answer any more questions on that, but that's really where I look.
Yeah, and I think it's a combination, and Peter could probably speak to this better than I, but it's taking our IRP and then our, what I would say, updated energy risk management philosophy, and it's how do we pull those two together to manage more effectively, right, reducing the risk at a price effective, in a price effective way.
That's the fun part, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is a fun part.
Mm-hmm. But to make a deficit in a kid like up this graph, we would have to have a vast amount of storage in the seaway.
I'm not saying we would, yeah, you know, invest in all the storage to make that up. It's taking what the IRP says,
right,
we will need, and then with these market swings and the market volatility, and the supply volatility, how do we manage that risk through our ERM?
I do have a question, and I'm not sure it relates to this presentation. Good work in finding solutions. However, there will be a point in time where we will be selling, correct?
Yes.
If we don't need it.
Absolutely. Yep.
And do our policies limit our ability to sell directly into the market, or does it go through our slice allocation? In other words, the sale. Is that,
Our policy doesn't limit us. We can,
all right, okay,
be, you know, like I said, our sort of guiding light is we keep our position near neutral, okay, in the short term, and we have a lot of leeway to do that. Of course, we're not going to sell it so that we, you know, are exposed to those markets when we don't need to be, and certainly not put us in a sort,
okay,
of unreliable situation. So we have a lot of leeway there.
All right, thank you.
The gist of it is really just holding more of that in reserve or holding more length. And that is, there is a cost, right? But to try to manage that risk of these pretty volatile or violent swings, and especially when, again, we have increased demand and lower supply, how do we navigate those? Because that's when the price volatility is at its greatest.
So you're saying we hold more length,
we're gonna hold,
and then if we have an incident like this, we've got that to use. But then the rest of the time, we're sort of selling that length sort of at the last minute when the value is not very high.
Yeah. Yeah, we're holding on to more,
right,
so that we can manage and not have to go into the market when prices are extremely high as much.
Right.
And so by holding that,
yeah,
we're then, yeah, we're not getting the upside of selling.
Yeah, we're not getting the value.
Yeah.
Well, we get some value.
I'm back to trying to restate my question. So we're selling. Is slice the product that we sell?
Yes.
The slice gives us the flexibility. So my question was, is that where we turn to in terms of selling what we don't need? Or going into the market and marketing what we don't need?
Yeah.
Or can we, in general, just with a very general sale or marketing, it doesn't have to go through slice?
No.
Okay.
We take our slice product, and
yeah,
then it could be our own generation, whatever we have excess.
So it's an average.
Yeah, and that's what our
yeah,
power schedule is.
You don't need it. It doesn't make any difference what product it is. All right,
yep,
thank you.
Let's zoom in into the peak week. So on the right side of the slide, you can see two plots. All areas and bars represent volume. So, and lines are prices. Let's look at the top part of the plot. So you can see that we planned for roughly 1,000 megawatts, but realized the actual load that we had was 1,200, right? And during the peak hour, this is unfortunately a typo on On the slide, during the peak hour, we have 1600 megawatts. So we have to buy, right, 300 up to 600 megawatts during this peak week, almost every day. And these bars showing us how much of the energy we bought on the day ahead and real time market. If you look at the lines, you see prices associated with these days. And you can see that prices were high for the first 3 days. And the highest price here is almost 1,000. So we had this risk when we don't have enough resources, when the load was very high. And at the same time, prices were very high. So this is a risky event. It happened sometime. And the occurrence of this event now more frequent in the sense we see them every year, the history of the past 3 years. So this is it. Here we'll review results of our risk tests.
All right, moving on to our risk tests. We're nearing the home stretch of the presentation here. So
good presentation. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah. Glad to hear us. Yeah, we added in a few new things, a few changes. So I'm glad it's being received well. So one of the tests we do is our financial load imbalance tests. And starting with the plot, what you can see is an observation on one of those tests. So we do multiple tests throughout the period, and it's just about one per day. And for each one of these horizons that we see in our short-term position, 36 months in advance, we do an individual test for. So there's lots more month tests because each day there's 36 tests over that 6 months. And there's fewer quarters which make up those months and calendars which make up those months. And book is the all of the positions all at once. Plotted on the x-axis there is the different time horizons, and then the actual limit there is at the 100% mark. And so what we're looking at here is a black line or black dot that's underneath that limit as being that would be under the limit, and the red dots would be over the limit for those specific tests. And these are for our open positions, and they tell us whether or not we're above or below the limits we set that we talked about previously. And the value of these open positions are not yet certain. Although we haven't split it apart in this graph, I would venture that 99.99% of these are long positions. So they represent us holding this length into this future and sort of preparing for the delivery months, right? And we have lots of red dots as well. There's multiple exceedances here. And the reason why we have this is because we saw and we have been seeing high market prices. So the value of that length we hold is valued high. And we have a preference for holding more energy, particularly as we think about transitioning to new targets and transitioning to a future where we're complying with RAP and other regional programs. And we're also considering these recent events where we're looking at what's going on with the month when we have these sort of extreme events. Okay, weekend comes to mind, and making sure that we're carrying more length. So we have a preference for holding more length at the expense of having some red dots here, some exceedances here in these tests.
So what is book?
Book would be all of the positions from now until the end of that 36 months. So if you just add them all up instead of take each
long
slice.
Term. Long term.
Long, well, we call it short term, but we can say it's the whole long term, short term portfolio. We're missing words here. But
very relative.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, another test that we look at is our price exposure test, is what we call it, but we look at those same positions and we make a hypothetical. Okay, if we have a long position, let's assume that prices go down very quickly, you know, and sort of extreme pricing event over the course of a week. If we have a short position, we assume the other one. If we know we're going to need to purchase energy here to get to where our targets are. What happens if prices shoot up very quickly over a week? And we set limits around this too to say, well, we don't want to face those exposures. And so we would then go and correct that by doing a transaction. And so what you can see here, starting with the left-hand side graph, the long position, these are all the tests. Again, pretty much every single day we do a test. And you can see the black dots being under the limit, the red dots being over the limit, and the same for short positions. You'll notice fewer dots in the short position because we have generally fewer short positions as we're always chasing our reserve margins, right? So again, there are multiple exceedances, red dots, and a similar sort of explanation as before. We see high market prices. We have a preference for holding more energy. With this test in particular, the volatility of prices that we observe matter. And so we do know that we've had a lot of volatile prices. You know, just one weekend can change the volatility picture quite significantly.
So why are there no exceedances in the book for the short position?
Because if you look at all 36 months that we have in our position, and we might have, you know, several months that we are short of a net neutral. So we're planning it out and we're saying, you know, what is it 12 months from now? What's our slice? What's our loads going to be? We add all that up and it comes out to, well, we're below zero, right? So we're planning, we're looking at situations like that. That's a short position. So if you add all those up for all 36 months, you can basically do this test, and we don't have significant enough positions and significant enough price exposure or price volatility over those periods to warrant an exceedance here. So, in that sense, again, supports the narrative that I'm saying is that we're sort of have this preference for holding more length. Our recent risk program improvements, just to touch upon these, we have some updates and some kind of future plans. We have implemented a forward sales moratorium to help retain positions in sensitive months. You know, again, looking at RAP and transitioning towards our RAP requirements. And so in the past, we have been more willing to sell these forward positions to respond to those exceedances. So we put in a moratorium in place now to avoid that and help us retain those positions. It doesn't mean that we will never sell those positions. It just means that we won't advance sell them beyond our targets. We're also pretty active in exploring opportunities to acquire these capacity needs as we move to new targets. Then we see these targets, which are sort of coming from the IRP, saying we need capacity type of things, right? And so this is adding to our reserves, as we saw. And so we now need to go out and really acquire those when we need it. So we're looking at that really seriously right now.
When there's a price advantage.
Well, we're not timing the market, but we're looking at the sort of best way. Usually we use the glide path to kind of allow us to average out the cost, but this is maybe a little bit different animal than our sort of run-of-the-mill transactions that we do. So we're kind of reviewing that and what the best, most appropriate procurement should be, depending on the actual need.
So we keep hearing from some of our constituents, they want to say, why are we doing more solar? And of course, I think we get enough information, we understand why we're not doing lots of solar. Mm-hmm. Again, it kind of gets back to the storage issue. And so we need to be able to explain to the public why we're not doing more and more solar, but while we're doing some, but they're mainly more in the don't want to say charity area, but you know, they're not really directed at our load deficits. I mean, are they?
So I think when you ask about you know, the solar, I usually will fall back on what the IRP tell us. And
right.
One really important part of that is you know, what we need as far as energy versus capacity. We're not energy constrained, especially when solar is out. We're you know, addressing a capacity problem primarily. And when we think about, you know, all of those needs added up and what solar can provide, you know, there's some pretty clear winners there within the IRP framework. That's not to say that we're not, you know, we're not supporting solar. I could definitely say with net metering, with our community solar projects. I mean, I think the district, this is, you know, my own sort of view here. I think the district is very supportive of, has been supportive of solar, particularly in the Northwest.
Yeah.
You know, we'll remain as committed as possible to that.
Yeah, that's right on. I mean, it really goes back to the IRP and what our needs are. And Peter was spot on. It's more of a capacity issue than it is an energy issue. Yeah, and that's really the capacity, right? Is the power there when we need it the most? And that's one of the things. So it's a great resource when it's there and can provide energy but it's not, we can't count on it.
Part of the path. Yeah.
Some other areas that we're looking into are to enhance our processes to respond to forecasted extreme events in the operational period. So it sounds like a bunch of jargon there, but basically when we see you know, weekends in the forecast coming up or stretches of cold weather and possible market events, you know, how do we position ourselves? How do we work together better as a team? You know, always to just focus on continuous improvement. And you know, as we you know, start seeing those sorts of events and thinking about what we can really do from a risk perspective to address those. In the future, we've talked previously about a standing financial hedging program. We're still working on that. I don't have any news on that today, but we are hoping that in short order, we will be able to consider that and bring that into our risk framework here. We're also evaluating different market and BPA products currently, as you know. And then one area that we haven't talked much about is we want to look at our procedural documents, look at our processes, our controls, and our practices to make sure that these things are in sync. We've been having some nice knowledge exchange activities with other utilities around the area to learn about how they do risk management. We think that this could be a good improvement to some of the stuff that doesn't usually get the highlights here, but it's nonetheless really important to make sure we are compliant, we're doing things as, you know, to the book as much as possible. And then that book reflects the practice, the best practice should be. I think that's what we had for the risk presentation. Any further questions?
No, just thank you. Thank you for the detail.
Sure, anytime.
Sure.
I do have one question.
Yes.
Update in future, and you said that we're working on it. Is this something that the board would expect a presentation on or learn the results of for the future? Items.
For the future items, yeah, I think we would definitely give an update on those things.
And this year, quarter 1/25.
So each one would probably be handled
separately.
You know, separately.
Okay.
But you know, I'd be glad to give you an update on the financial hedging when we have something definitive to say on that.
Yeah.
And can.
I was just looking for.
Yeah.
I think it's an important thing to consider, and you know, are we in quarter 3, quarter 4 of this year, or going into 2025. I know this is complex.
I think we will provide updates at the next, what is that?
Quarter.
October, last October.
Okay, all right, good, thank you.
Risk presentation, and we'll have a better idea of kind of the status and what else is going on.
Okay, thank you.
I guess it's safe to say we're not ready to call ourselves hedgehogs.
Oh, good grief. She's on top of it.
You beat me to a punch.
We needed that at the end of the risk presentation to just keep us going. Thank you very much.
Peter, I have a question. So, slide 11 shows those new targeted positions.
Yes.
You don't need to go to it.
Okay.
So we've been talking about financial risk this whole time.
Yes.
Is the reserve policy substantially changed our risk of not being able to load?
No, no, it wouldn't. So, I mean, I think that's a tough question, to be fair.
It is a tough question.
You know, do we think that markets are illiquid enough that we wouldn't be able to meet load with market as well? I think what this is telling us is that we're adding capacity volumetric reserves on top of what we have had in place as sort of energy-driven reserves. So we will be in a better position than we were before. And transitioning to compliance with the RAP, which is really meant to, as a region, to make sure that we have the capacity needed to prevent these inadequacies, right? So I think if anything, directionally, this will be helping us to sort of make sure we have the physical assets to be reliable and to be able to call upon them when we need them most and not rely on the market to sort of fill in otherwise as much.
Any follow-up questions?
No, but thank you.
Well, I appreciate that we have smart people working on this. And thank you, Dr. Lowe, for joining our team. Glad you're here.
And I want to repeat, this presentation was well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, it really was.
Now, Dr. Gow, I talked to.
All of you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, great job, Peter and Anna.
Yeah, let's take a short break and come back at, I guess, 10:40.
10:40.
All right, 10:40. We have next words, John.
All right, for an exciting new benefit program proposal for changes for non-represented employees, Dana Paolo. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. So this is just a... I gotta use the clicker. So just a reminder, on the April 2nd meeting, you approved the CBA and the benefit changes for represented employees. So what we're talking today about is the benefit changes for non-represented employees, which are the same, except for effective dates. Some of them will be future effective dates. And then also on May 7th will be the resolution with all of the details. We're just gonna do high level today for the changes. So we're going to talk about the medical, the health, the life insurance, and some retirement benefits. I'm going to go fast. So a little bit of background. The Benefit Advisory Committee, the BAC, we met for about 15 times, which we were kind of counting those, and it felt like a lot more because they were either half-day meetings or all-day meetings. So it was pretty intense. To review information back from employees through the All Benefit Employee Survey that we had, different market surveys that we also had, Northwest Benefit Survey Market, and other utilities, both public and private. We also looked at some non-standard PPO coverage changes and recommend to implement some of those, and we'll go through those high level, and then some continuous improvement opportunities as well. So for the medical and dental increases to the deductibles, we haven't had a change in that for probably 10 years. So we were well above market with very low deductibles and out-of-pocket maximum. So we are recommending to increase both of those starting in 2025. Adding 30,000 lifetime coverage for infertility that came out of the All Employee Benefit Survey, kind of a DEI initiative, and also recruitment and retention. Some increases to chiropractic and acupuncture, also increasing both of those to 24 visits per year. And then some of the standardization for the PPO benefit provisions. Retail supply is currently 31 days, so we're going to be going to 30. And then also adding deductibles for some of the benefit provisions for out-of-network providers, which is pretty standard. There was just a few that didn't have it for some reason over time. Delta Dental, we heard this from the benefit survey. Lots of employees wanted this to add orthodontic coverage to the Delta Dental plan. So we are adding net coverage of $2,000. So what that means is that if orthodontic coverage costs $6,000, the benefit covers $2,000. So the employee would, or family member would still have to pay $4,000 for that. And then increasing grant coverage from 60 to 80%. So that's a good thing there too, a recommendation. I-Med Vision, adding an eye exam on this plan for a $10 copay. That was definitely a continual improvement because we have lots of employees confused. If they're going to iMed, they're having to pay for their full vision exam if it's not in the Primera or Kaiser network. So that's that will be a nice thing to add, and that will also be for 2025.
So going back to the previous slide.
Yes.
So the increase in deductibles, are they significant?
No. So currently on the PPO plan, it's at $150 and it's going up to $250. We're still within the market that it's at the still the low end for public employers. It's usually between $250 to
$500. Thank you.
Okay, moving on to life, AD&D, short for accidental death and dismemberment and voluntary benefits. So the core term life has been $50,000 for a long time, and we were actually well under market on this. So recommending to increase the core term life to the one-time base salary, excludes overtime, up to the $300,000. And that's also the same coverage for the core AD&D plan that we're also adding. Again, that is usually bundled together. And this is in addition to the already existing voluntary plan that we have. That's an additional buy-up, but that plan is 100% employees, but those two plans are paid by the district. And then voluntary benefits, we're looking to add those three benefits, but those are going to be delayed until 2026, and the voluntary benefits will be paid by employees if they choose to elect that. District contribution changes. So again, this is basically if there's the premiums for medical and dental plan, the district pays a percentage of those premiums. There are small percent changes for both the medical and dental. So the percentage of the district contribution is going down a little bit in some cases. So the employees will pay just a little bit more out of pocket. And the percents are listed in the attachment that will be going along with the commission resolution May 7th. We don't know the rates obviously yet for 2025. Those are determined until November or October. And then adding the new AD&D contribution benefit, and then increasing the health savings account. And that plan is tied to the high deductible health plan. So you have to be enrolled in that plan to be enrolled in the HSA plan. And that is increasing the annual, those are annual amounts there that the district is contributing. Employee-only coverage, $1,500. Family coverage is anybody enrolled in the high deductible health plan for two or more dependents is what family coverage.
Do we have many employees on the high deductible?
We have about, right about 40. And that plan, just a reminder, it was implemented July 1st of 2021. In the COVID, that was fun. Part-time employees, a few changes there. Anybody who works under an average of 30 hours, we're going to be offering medical, dental, and vision again. That was something that was changed in the last CBA. Anybody under 30 hours was no longer offered medical, dental, and vision. So we're changing that back, effective 2025.
30 hours. Was it 20 hours?
No, actually all part-time employees were offered medical, dental, and vision before the last contract.
Part-time.
Yeah. Anybody part-time, yes. Under basically 39 hours or less was considered part-time, but on average, if it's somebody worked under 30 hours starting in 2022 with that contract, they were no longer offered medical. They worked under 30 hours.
What is the definition of part-time here?
Oh, okay, sorry about that.
Is the definition of part-time 30 hours a week?
So, kind of from an employment perspective, anything at the district under 39 hours is kind of considered part-time here as an employment status, but under ACA, Affordable Care Act, that is the requirement of 30 hours from that definition.
Do we have minimum employees in this under 30-hour average?
Altogether, part-time employees, we have about 23 employees. Three are enrolled in medical, but I don't, each year it changes who's under and over averages, so I don't have those numbers. It's probably close to 50-50, or a little less on the under 30 hours. Part-time pay in lieu of rate, that is a rate that's been offered to part-time employees since I've been employed here. And it's basically to use to offset purchasing medical, dental, or vision. With some changes that happened in the last contract, it wasn't based on a formula anymore, it was just a flat rate. So the Benefit Advisory Committee looked at that and definitely wanted to tie that rate of pay to what the cost would be to purchase employee-only coverage. So we are going back to more of the formula that it used to be. You can see the formula, but we don't know the rates, the premiums for the next years, but I would imagine that for 2025, that rate is gonna go down under $8 just based on the premiums for employee-only coverage for HMO and Willamette. So that will be less paid to employees, but the cost has gone down too from some changes that happened last contract. Moving on to a couple of things with retirement and savings. The Retirement Health Savings Plan, which is offered to anybody hired after July 1st of 2009, employer contribution, employees can't contribute to this plan. Currently, the amount is $57.30. But looking at market, we were pretty low actually on that. So the BAC committee recommended to increase that amount sooner than later, so July, up to the 125, and then a year and a half down the road, up to 150. And then also looking at increasing the 401k employer match, 0.5% staggered throughout the years.
I have a question on this one. Wasn't there at RHS prior to 2009 that employees prior to that had something similar, retired?
The plan prior to that is the HRA, this alphabet soup with benefits. So the HRA is Health Retirement Account, and that account is $180 a month contribution.
Okay, that's what I recall. Does that still exist?
It does.
Okay.
And then also a few more changes to the retiree program is the coverage levels are gonna basically mirror the employee coverages now. So instead of single, double, multiple, it'll be employee only, spouse, children, and then family. So there'll be four coverage levels. And then the rate structure is also changing, but along with that, the district contribution for medical for employees hired before 7109 is also changing to kind of be in relation to the coverage level and rate structure changes. And then good news on this one, they'll be recommending to add two new retiree dental plans. So currently we don't offer a dental plan, it's actually just through COBRA. So somebody who retires can elect COBRA up to 18 months, but these new plans would be for however long a retiree would want to pay. So it's 100% paid by the retiree. And then a few miscellaneous slides. On the top one, COBRA medical dental subsidy of 100%, kind of missed that part in there, for up to 12 months upon a retiree or employee dying if they were on medical coverage. This would help pay the family's survivor benefits for up to a year. So we've had, unfortunately, a few situations like that happen, so this would be awesome to help families through at least the first year. And COBRA can be, in the case of a death, actually COBRA coverage can be up to 3 years or 36 months. Advance notice incentive pay, this was introduced after the last contract. A few changes just with administrative because we've had some issues. It's hard to know when you're going to retire a year from now. So we had a lot of different changes where people were changing their retirement date. So we were recommending to change the notification from 1 year to 6 months and then just changing the dollar amount to be to essentially up to the same amount.
Can you describe for me what is that program?
Yes, so So if somebody provides notice to the district that they're going to be separating or retiring, so it's offered in both cases, a minimum of 90 days, then they are paid out upon their last final paycheck. The calculation between the day that they're providing the district notification until their last payday. So it could be from 90 days up to a year right now, but it changed for representative employees to 6 months. So it could be a maximum of, I can't remember, $4,000 up to the maximum. So basically the purpose is to provide advance notice to the district, to managers, to succession plan, to backfill.
Okay, it is related to succession plan.
Yes, yes.
That's what I was looking for.
So kind of all of what I just went over, this is just kind of a estimate of what the cost would be for non-represented employees. So I just broke it down. I do have the cost for total, but the first year is basically the increase in the RHS funding difference that's gonna, that we're recommending for July 1st. And then the years after, the big bulk of it is the RHS and the 401k match increase. Those are the biggest that make up that number. And then next steps will be the May 7th commission resolution with all of the details of what I just went over high level. Also, we're planning to do educational sessions like we did for represented employees, but we would also be doing those if passed or if approved for non-represented employees in May, just because everybody's jumping at the bit to understand what's coming. But that would be in addition to open enrollment presentations too in the fall of this year. We're planning on a 3-week open enrollment just because of all the changes. So making sure people feel comfortable with all of them.
Okay.
Questions, commissioners?
When is this effective then?
Each of the, the provisions are a little different. Mostly the medical, dental plans and life insurance plans are effective the first of the next year. And then some of them are a little bit more off sooner just to implementation with everything or trying to stagger that. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dana. Next is the exciting presentation around proposed leave program changes. Employees and Renee McWaters. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Renee McWaters, and I am in human resources in the Leaves area, and I'm also a member of the Leaves Advisory Committee. And I'll be briefing you today about recommended leave program changes for non-represented employees. A resolution for your consideration for approval of these leave changes for non-represented employees will be on the May 7th commission meeting agenda. And as Dana mentioned in the previous presentation, the benefit and leave changes for represented employees were approved by you earlier this month. Today's agenda includes background of what led up to the proposed leave program changes, along with what those recommended changes are, including a new program for district paid family and medical leave. And this program would have a delayed implementation date. And so there's other leave program changes that are recommended to start earlier. So we'll also touch on that. And leave time for questions. Although if you have any questions along the way, please feel free.
I'll wait till the end, yeah.
I'd like to add that there are cost estimates for the different proposals that are throughout the presentation. And these cost estimates are for all district employees, not just non-represented employees. And so for a little background, the Leave Advisory Committee was tasked with doing a deep dive, looking at district leave programs and seeing if any changes were recommended. And we've met for several months. We had more than 20 meetings, many of them all day. And we did a deep dive into leave, district leave programs. We also looked at feedback from employees from the employee survey that was conducted in 2023. We worked with a benefits consultant to look at market and what other employers are providing in their leave programs. And we looked at cost data. Areas of concern that were identified were a general dissatisfaction with the extended sick leave program, and also payroll taxes paid by both employees and the district to the state for the Washington Paid Family and Medical Leave Program far exceeded any benefits PUD employees were receiving. For example, in 2023, taxes paid by the district and employees to the state were over $1 million, while employees were only paid about $285,000 in benefits. We also identified a couple programs that were below market, and a common theme was that district leave programs are complex to administer and for a lot of employees to understand, due to the multiple programs and laws and how they interact with each other. The most significant recommendation is for a new district paid family and medical leave program, which we are calling Snow Leave. This would have a delayed implementation date of July 1st, 2026, and would offer paid leave for family, medical, and parental bonding leave. It would provide greater benefits for the majority of employees, and the administration of this program would be in-house and paid through payroll. It would essentially be taking the state Washington Paid Family Medical Leave Program, moving it in-house and self-insuring it. It would then be considered a voluntary plan subject to state approval. Snow Leave would replace the Washington Paid Family and Medical Leave, extended sick leave, and short-term disability programs, and we would use the money that the district and employees are currently paying to the state to help fund this program, along with the district dollars that are spent on the extended sick leave program and short-term disability. Snow Leave would be less complex to administer and easier for the majority of employees and managers to understand. The estimated annual cost for the district would be $3.8 million, employee would be $800,000, and the estimated additional cost to the district for Snow Leave over current costs are $900,000. Any questions so far?
Oh, there's backing up. No, we go first.
Okay. So on slide number four, the $285,000 that were paid by the state for benefits, that was statewide?
No, that's for district employees. So claims that district employees made to the Washington Paid Family.
Oh, sorry, I didn't read it carefully enough, because wasn't there an issue in the legislature? An initiative to get rid of that plan, or to,
I'm not aware of
it. Initiative to opt out, I believe.
Oh, to opt out.
I believe that that is for the Washington CARES Act, which is the long-term disability plan.
Oh, that was the CARES Act. Okay.
There's so many acronyms going around. So we're talking about the Washington Paid Family and Medical Leave
Program. Okay, thank you for straightening me out on that.
Any other questions?
So the changes replace that plan.
Yes.
It's not in addition to, or, okay.
Correct. So the Snow Leap plan design would largely be modeled after the state Washington Paid Family and Medical Leave Program. And it, we would be required to meet the minimum requirements of the regulations of that program. We do recommend a few enhancements to the program in the benefits paid and the waiting period. Employees would be eligible for 12 to 18 weeks of paid family and/or medical leave in a 12-month period. The first 6 weeks would be paid at 100% of the employee's base pay, and the remaining weeks would be paid at 80% of the employee's base pay. Employees can elect to use their own PTO to top up that 80% benefit to 100%.
And the use of PTO is at the end, that side of it, or can you use PTO elsewhere?
During the waiting period, an employee would need to use their PTO.
Okay.
However, during, while using Snow Leap, they would not need to use PTO. The waiting period would be 1 to 3 days for a qualifying event in a claim year. And this is due to how the regulations define the waiting period, and they look at a calendar week. A qualifying event would be a medical event where the employee has their own serious health condition, bond with a new child, either through birth, adoption, or foster placement, caring for a family member with a serious health condition, or if they're experiencing a qualifying exigency related to military service of a family member. Medical certification would be required in order to access Snow Leap benefits, and the benefit is renewable each claim year.
So the bonding with a new child, would that be applicable to both parents?
Correct.
Great.
Due to the delayed implementation, we do have some recommendations for our ESL program to go into effect currently, effective April 1st of 2024, and that's to expand access for extended sick leave, allowing employees to have immediate access to extended sick leave for outpatient surgeries. Currently, that's only for inpatient hospitalization. And also to allow employees to access extended sick leave for additional family members and for parental bonding leave. And then on July 1st, 2026, when Snow Leap begins, the extended sick leave program would end. And all the money that the district is currently spending to fund ESL would be allocated to Snow Leap. And the ESL balances that employees have at that time would freeze. There would be no further accruals and no further use of ESL for medical or bereavement leave. Employees would have the continued ability to use out or cash out 30% of their frozen ESL balance at the time of retirement, or 50% in the case of the death of an employee with an ESL balance. And employees who have large ESL balances would continue to be able to transfer or convert some of those ESL hours every year to PTO hours based on a revised schedule.
Can you, that last bullet, can you give me an example?
So I don't have the table.
Well, I'm not talking about numbers.
So currently, I believe if your balance is over 900 hours for ESL, you have 4 hours converted to PT, or 4 days converted to PTO at your anniversary date. So this would keep up with that, but it has revised that table a little bit.
Okay.
Also effective July 1st, 2026, when snow leave would go into effect, we recommend, well, because there would be no further use of ESL, employees currently use ESL to fund their bereavement leave. So the recommendation is to have it be separate and funded by the district without accruals. It would be on a pay-as-you-go basis. There would be no other changes to bereavement for the length per occurrence or the eligible family members. And the estimated annual cost is $170,000. For short-term disability, effective January 1st, 2025, we recommend increasing the short-term disability maximum payment from 60 calendar days to 90 calendar days to create continuity to get to that 90-day long-term disability waiting period. And then, effective July 1st, 2026, when snow leave begins, short-term disability would end, and the money that the district is paying to fund short-term disability would be allocated to the snow leave program. Long-term disability is a program that is currently under market here at the district. Our recommendations effective 1-1 of 25 is to increase the monthly benefit maximum from $5,000 to $10,000. This $10,000 maximum benefit would cover base earnings of up to $200,000 per year. We recommend eliminating the 60 and 120-day waiting period and leave only the 90-day waiting period option available. The district would continue to pay 100% of the 90-day waiting period premium, but it would be paid on an after-tax basis, which means that when employees are receiving an LTD benefit, they do not need to pay taxes on that. We would change the benefit from 60% to 50%, but because that benefit payment isn't taxed, the employee is essentially receiving the same amount. And the annual cost savings for these changes is $40,000.
I don't understand the tax thing. Is that something the IRS doesn't tax?
So if the premium is taxed, when you're paid the benefit, it isn't taxed.
Oh, I understand. Okay, the premium.
And currently, we don't tax the premium, but the benefit itself is taxed.
Okay, I understand.
Other slide. Do people just have?
Yeah, they just.
Okay, sorry. We also recommend the addition of a floating holiday. This would be a new district paid holiday to go into effect 1/1/26, and it wouldn't have a specified date. Employees could use the floating holiday as best suits them. It could be time taken off for a variety of reasons, for a mental health day, to observe a cultural or religious holiday that isn't formally recognized by the district, or just because they need a day off. And employees would need to, I don't have the slide with me. It would be on a use it or lose it basis with no carryover into the next year. And it would need to be taken in full day increments with paid at 8 hours per day. And it would also support diversity, equity, and inclusion.
So is this a holiday that then wouldn't have to be, have any pre-approval?
It has low notice for, low employee notice. There would be some restrictions around the day before and the day after a district recognized holiday, and also during a major storm or major emergency. In those cases, the employee would require a manager approval. And the estimated cost for this is $600,000. And that is what I have. Are there any questions?
No, I just appreciate what an excellent way you present.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's very good articulation, very clear into the mind, the whole thing. Thank you. It's very interesting.
How long is the list?
I thought you were giving me the evil eye. Actually, if I keep my mouth shut, most of my questions are answered. I do have a question on, go back to page 8. And my question is, under the indented bullets of the bonding with new children, is adoption or foster placement new?
That's currently covered under FMLA and under the Washington Paid Family and Medical Leave Program.
Oh, so it will transfer. All right, thank you. And then this floating holiday thing. Why am I getting laughs?
Because it's all the same.
It's a thing. Well, you said that there were some restrictions with regard to, is that the day before and the day after? Is that regarding notice, advance notice?
So, for the most part, you know, if an employee knows ahead of time that they want to use their floating holiday for something, we would want them to let their manager know for coverage purposes. But if the employee wakes up one morning and decides that they need a mental health day, they would just call in and use their floating holiday, and they wouldn't need to provide any reasons.
Really?
However, if it's the day before or after a district recognized holiday, when coverage is a little tight, they would need to have manager approval if they wanted to use their floating holiday, and they would need to provide advance notice.
In terms of scheduling work, I mean, this is not a big deal to me, but those areas of the company where you have like call center, or like dispatch of line crews and stuff, isn't that set up the day before? So does this, you know, with picking up the phone in the morning and saying, I want to use this because I had a bad day yesterday. And so was that considered? Okay.
We did have customer service weigh in on this while we were coming up with recommendations, and we do need to see what the impacts are. And we'll have an opportunity to see that with the delayed implementation, and if there's any tweaks that are needed, we can maybe look at that at the next negotiation cycle.
Okay, well, I remember that was a frustration for the call center. The crew component, you know, if you're making up a crew for the next day's work.
Yeah, I will say, just we have opportunities in that regard now in the call center on ensuring, you know, last minute call-ins. And,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. But our new AGM is all over that.
Oh God. And is this
new job?
New
John. Is this
Young John?
Yeah.
Is this floating holiday pretty standard? I mean, in terms of our being competitive with.
Yes.
with other employees.
Floating holidays in market are much more popular, mostly because of that DEI component to allow people that time to take time off at a time that's important to them.
The board receives the same benefits as the employees, so does that mean I got ticked off?
Are you saying you're going to use your floating holiday this afternoon?
What if you just want to go out and float?
I think you always have an option, Commissioner. Any other questions? Serious or otherwise? All right, thank you very much.
Excellent job, Renee. Well, that does it for our presentation this morning.
Okay, it is now 11:18, and the board will recess into executive session to discuss current or potential litigation under the terms set forth in the Open Public Meetings Act. It is anticipated the executive session will last approximately 30 minutes and conclude at 11:48. Regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.